But perhaps the subtitle gives more of a clue of what I'm going to be talking about in the first part of my talk, which is how we can try and classify the computational power of entangled states. So this is work that is joint with my postdoc, Janet Anders. Okay, so I'm the first person to talk about measurement-based quantum computation in this workshop, apart from Robert's eloquent introduction yesterday. So I'll give a sort of an overview of this area at the beginning of my talk for those of you who aren't so familiar with it. So I start with an analogy, okay? So what I want you to do is sort of throw away all your conceptions about what a quantum computer is, okay? So a quantum computer is no longer a series of unitary gates applied to a register of qubits with measurement right at the end. Now, quantum computation is something much closer to this, okay? You go out and you purchase from your handy marble seller a resource. So a resource being an entangled state, such as a cluster state or a graph state, okay? And you take your resource, and this basically has all the entanglement you need for the quantum computation you want to do, because all you need to do is make single qubit measurements. So make no further entangling operations, and if you make measurements in the right bases and in the right order, you'll get at the end the desired computational output. So you can really think of this as taking your resource and chipping it away until you've got the output that you want. Okay? Now, a bit more precisely, the sort of entangled resources that we normally consider are states, multi-qubit states, such as the cluster state. Okay? And the cluster state is a state which is entangled over a large number of qubits. And we take this resource state, we measure a subset of the qubits. We don't measure all of the qubits at once, okay? We only measure a subset of the qubits, because based on these measurement results, we then have to choose the measurement bases for the next round of measurements. And then this is, again, only a subset of the remaining measurements. We make those measurements, and we do some more processing on those measurement results, and this gives us the information we need to determine the bases for the next measurements we make. So we go round. Measurement-based quantum computation is sort of described by this loop here. We go around this loop until we've finally measured all of the qubits, and then by processing those measurement outcomes, we can extract the computational output that we want. Okay, so I also the first person to talk about cluster states and the idea of graph state. So what's a cluster state? What's a graph state? Well, a cluster state is a multi-qubit state with an extremely simple description. You just take a lattice of qubits. So these blue dots now represent qubits. And you can think of this stretching off to infinity in both directions. Okay, this is a big, big, big lattice. And each qubit is prepared in the superposition state 0 plus 1. And then a series of entangling gates are applied. These are the control Z gate. There's the matrix representation in the computational basis. So control Z gates are applied between all neighbors on the lattice, both in this direction and in this direction. And you've seen that I've drawn little lines to represent this entangling operation. In fact, this is a graphical language for entangled states, which is called the graph state description. And any state that can be written in terms of a graph following this description is a graph state. So the prescription is very, very simple. You just take, for every node on your graph, you take a qubit prepared in state 0 plus 1, and then you apply a CZ gate between all pairs of qubits connected on the graph. So this is the graph state formalism. And it provides an extremely compact and simple way of specifying, of writing down these multi-particle entangled states. Okay, so that's the overview of measurement-based quantum computation. Now you might be wondering, how in all of this do we actually specify the quantum computation that we want to do? Normally in the quantum circuit model picture, what we do is we choose a certain circuit of logic gates. So, and the particular circuit would describe the quantum algorithm we wanted to achieve. How then is this encoded in the measurement-based model? Well, what we do is we have choices over the basis we use for these single qubit measurements. Okay, we can choose any pairs of orthogonal single qubit states. So this gives us a lot of freedom. And in fact, by suitably choosing the measurement bases, you can get outputs which are equivalent to the outputs of any circuit model computation, provided you start off with a cluster state that's big enough. And the correspondence between the circuit model computation and the cluster state computation are quite close. You can actually associate patterns of measurements with particular logic gates. So this is a figure which I cut out of this very old paper, which had some early ideas of how we could implement logic gates in this model. So you see there you've got the CNOT gate and single qubit operations. So that's a universal set of gates. But an important thing to notice is that the labels on each of these sites correspond to the measurement bases which are used to measure a particular qubit. But some of these sites, it's not quite so easy to see, so I'll zoom it in. Some of these sites have a symbol with a plus and minus in front of it. And that's because these symbols represent angles. And in fact, the sign of the angle is not specified when we first specify the measurement pattern. So where does this sign come from? This sign is a function of the previous measurement outcomes. So it's this sign which the feedback loop is calculating. The classical processing on the previous measurement outcomes is what gives you this sign, okay? So in the standard approaches to measurement-based quantum computation, it's normally pairs of measurement bases like these are what pop up, and you can see they're the same except for the sign of this angle here, okay? And why do we need this adaptivity? Why can't we just specify a fixed set of bases in the beginning? Well, each of these measurement outcomes is random. In fact, in the cluster state, if you look at the reduced density matrices of the individual qubits, they're all maximally mixed. So the a priori probability of any of these measurement outcomes is a half. So all of these measurements are leading to an extremely random evolution of the state of the unmeasured qubits. And it's this adaptivity which ensures that in spite of this inherent randomness, you still achieve a deterministic computation. So this adaptivity is an extremely important part of the whole model. I mean, without it, it wouldn't work. Okay, so now cluster states are not the only states that we know about that have this special property of being universal resources. And by universal resource, I mean a state that given, well, it's really a family of states that given a particular quantum circuit that we want to implement, we can always find a state large enough to admit measurements which would be equivalent to that circuit. So there's a whole family of different lattice structured states which have been found in this paper here. And I believe Hans had originally planned to talk about this, but perhaps Katarina will talk about this later in the week. Anyway, the basic idea is that these are also graph states. So these lines, it's only the blue lines you need to worry about, actually. The blue lines correspond to the entangling operations. And you see all these different regular lattice structures also give you a universal resource. In fact, even irregular structures can give you universal resources too. If you take a percolation lattice, where each of the sites is only filled with a certain probability p, you get what's called a percolation model. And it's possible that Jens will talk about this in his talk. But it turns out that even for these very random graphs, as long as you're above a certain probability called the percolation threshold, you get something which is a universal resource. Okay. And all of the examples on this slide are graph states. Okay. So it's a natural question to ask whether you require the special properties of graph states to achieve universal quantum computation. Well, in fact, you don't. And there's a paper by Jens Lysert and David Gross, which I believe Jens may be talking about tomorrow, which gives a different formulation built upon the matrix product state formalism. Okay, so this is a whole new family of states which are universal for measurement-based quantum computation. So I want to go back to one of the questions that Robert alluded to in his introduction. And in fact, I've stolen it directly from his slide. So this is exactly what he had there. So what are the essential quantum mechanical properties that make these states universal? So what is it? What's going on? What entanglement properties are necessary? And sort of what physics is going on? Why does this even work? So that's the sort of question that I want to motivate the work in this talk, really. And one of the nice comparisons Robert made was between measurement-based quantum computation and the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper. And there they have this setup where they conclude that the quantum mechanical description of nature isn't complete because they can't assign elements of reality to the theory in the way they'd like to. So the reason why this didn't work essentially was because they were using a local hidden variable model. I mean, their assumptions were based on that. And so later, John Bell and CHSNH, Klauser, Horn, Shimoni, and Holt, together formed this useful quantity, which is a good way of determining when measurements on an entangled state are doing something which is incompatible with the assumption of a local hidden variable model. So this quantity here is a sum of expectation values, okay? And we call this the CHSH H quantity. And essentially, each one of these values is an expectation value of the product of the measurement outcome here and the measurement outcome here, okay? So let's assume that these are qubits on each side. That's not even necessary, but we assume that the measurement outcomes are plus and minus one. Okay, and then we can form these expectation values as the product, as the expectation of the product of those measurement outcomes. And what John Bell showed, and these guys showed in this form, was that local hidden variable models do not allow values of C to be greater than two. Okay, this is Bell's theorem. And this is violated by quantum mechanics up to a bound derived by Cyrilson, which is 2√2. So there's something in the measurements on entangled states, certain measurements we can do on these entangled states, which is incompatible with a local hidden variable model. Now, another nice example of this is the GHZ paradox, in particular in the form introduced by Merman in this paper. And what these guys observed is that if you look at this three-party entangled state, again, a state with a very simple description, you can write down eigenvalue equations which this satisfies, okay? And these are eigenvalue equations where the operators are tensor products across the different qubits. So because the state satisfies these eigenvalue equations, I can interpret this as telling me something certain about the correlations in these measurement outcomes. And it means if I measure the Pauli X operator on the first, the X on the second, and the X on the third qubits, I know that the product of these measurement outcomes is always going to be plus one. And similarly for these sets of measurements here. Now, just taking these three operators and multiplying them together gives you an operator for which the state also has to be an eigenstate. But this operator, just because of the anti-commutation between X and Y, this operator picks up a minus sign. So these three equations imply this equation, which tells you that these three measurements, when you find the product of them, you'll get minus one. And what GHZ and Merman noticed was that there's no sort of prior classical assignment of these variables which can satisfy simultaneously these four equations. So if you wanted to replace these operators with just simple statements about the correlation of pre-existing data, you wouldn't be able to assign these variables in a way that satisfies all of these. Okay, so that's just an example of some of the features of quantum mechanics and entanglement which we've looked at over the years. Now I want to look back at this measurement-based quantum computation and focus on, you know, trying to understand better the properties of entangled states which lead to a computational resource power. But first, the first thing I'm going to do is try and paint a more concrete picture of what we actually mean by computational resource power. I mean, at the moment, it's rather a vague concept that somehow we have these states and they enable universal quantum computation, but I want to be a bit more specific about what we mean by that. And the way I'm going to do this is to focus back onto the classical computer, which is doing all of the calculations which enable the adaptive measurements. So there's a classical computer at the heart of this scheme, and it's necessary. And because it's a classical computer, I can consider its properties using standard techniques of classical computer science. So what's this computer doing? It's recording the measurement outcomes from each site. So you can think of these as each of the qubits that are being measured, and they're sending back the bit that they measure after their measurement. It's calculating this dependency function, which calculates the sign which goes into the measurement bases of certain measurements. And then once that sign is calculated, it's sending down the bit which corresponds to that sign down to this particular measurement device here. And this is really the only component of the model which has any resemblance to a standard computer. It's the only really active computational element here. So, because it's a classical computer, we can use classical complexity theory to talk about its computational power. And the power of a polynomial-sized universal classical computer is simply the complexity class P, okay? And we call the power of a polynomial set of universal quantum gates, acting on qubits, as a representation of the complexity class BQP. So using this complexity theory terminology, we can say that we can be a bit more concrete about what we mean about the computational power of the cluster states, right? Just by taking our polynomial, our P computer, our classical computer, and allowing it to exchange bits with measurements on the cluster state, we promote it essentially from a P device to a BQP device. So this resource here is really allowing this guy up here to be promoted in computational power. And I want to interpret this perhaps as an intrinsic computational power, which is in the cluster state, because it's not clear where else this computational power is coming from. So I've said that the control computer is calculating signs of these measurement angles. What are the actual calculations that this computer is doing? Well, it turns out these are extremely simple calculations. In fact, they're nothing other than parity calculations. The reason for this is rather technical. And in fact, it will probably become more transparent once Jens Isert has introduced some of the formalism, which I think he's going to talk about. So I won't go into the technical details here. But the essential idea is that what this computer is doing is evaluating products of operators like this. So we've got an operator raised to the power of a bit. The bit is either 0 or 1, clearly. And these bits are the measurement outcomes. And another way of writing this is as the Pauli operator to the power of the parity of these bits. And it's these parity calculations that the control computer is carrying out. Now, parity calculations do not actually require a universal classical computer. You can get away with a simpler computational model, which can do everything needed for the classical control in the one-way model of measurement-based quantum computation. And it's something which we call a parity computer, or sometimes a CNOT computer. And this is a computer which has a gate set which consists of NOT and CNOT. And as is well known, this set of reversible gates is not universal. So it's not universal for classical computation. But it has been studied to a certain extent. And in fact, if you look at polynomial size circuits of these gates, these also induce a complexity class, which is known as parity L. Okay, so what this means is that we can take our measurement-based quantum computation, we can take the classical computer controlling it, we can throw that away, replace it with this limited power parity L device, and the whole thing will still work. And it means, so what else do we know about this parity L class? Ah, yes.
L? Is it because you only need log space for it or something?
There's an extremely technical reason for the name, which I don't really want to go into. If you're interested, it's in the complexity zoo. So just think of it as a label for now, okay? It is related to log space. What the problems which sit in this complexity class can consist of parity calculations. That's sort of quite straightforward to verify. But also, from a quantum computing point of view, the Clifford group circuits. So we've heard about this a couple of times today, but Clifford group circuits acting on just states in registers prepared in the zero state are classically efficiently simulatable or simulierbar. And in fact, they're simulierbar even by a parity computer. So you don't require universal classical computation even to do to simulate Clifford group circuits. Okay.
Oh, just a question. I mean, yes. Is this really true? I mean, do you mean modulo the signs? I mean, modulo the measurement outcomes, or including the measurement outcomes? I thought.
Which bit are you doubting?
Simulation, the deterministic simulation. Well,
you could turn and ask the person sitting behind you.
Yeah. I
should have said this was shown by Dan Dobson and Scott Aronson.
Actually, it was shown by Scott Aronson.
Okay.
The paper that I had also some results in.
But, okay.
So it's kind of true.
Yes.
The thing is that you can even get the measurement results, but this is under, I believe, log space reductions. So it's kind of some C naught and some other very weak
yes.
computation that you have to put together. Really,
I mean that's what I mean by deterministic.
You don't need to multiply, is what you're saying.
Well, you kind of only need very limited multiplication. Basically, you need to multiply. You know, you basically have to do mod 4 arithmetic in order to handle the measurement outcomes because the phase is accumulating.
Okay. Anyway, I should move on.
I think mod 4 gives you an addition minus 2.
So we can debate this, but later. But in terms of calculating parity, it's certainly something which this can do. And indeed, if you only consider deterministic Clifford group operations, then you don't have to worry about the things you were discussing. So, okay. So this means we can classify the computational power of the cluster state as even greater than previously indicated. Not only does it boost a control computer from P to BQP, it boosts it from parity L to BQP. But now we have a whole zoo of other kinds of resource that we can consider. Are there resources which, you know, won't work if we only have a parity L control computer? They require some universal classical computer to control them. Are there resources which only boost you up from parity L to universal classical computation? So, okay, first I'll very briefly look at these classes here, because this again connects with the talk that Jens is going to give later in the week. And what Jens and David introduced in their paper was a different way of accounting for the randomness, a different way for correcting for that. And that basically leads to a whole different structure of calculations that the control computer needs to do. And essentially what it needs to do is to count modulo some value, okay? And it turns out counting is not something which the parity computer can do. In fact, it needs a universal classical computer. That's very easy to show. So it's quite likely that the states introduced, or many of the states introduced in this paper, actually form in a different computational resource class to the cluster state, going from P up to BQP. Okay, so now let's look at the other class. What kind of states would be resources which would boost you from this parity L class up to universal classical computation? So let's have a look at some ways of coming up with this. Well, it's clear that if we can somehow repeatedly and efficiently simulate one of these gates, then this will enable us to achieve universal classical computation. Okay, we've got NOT and CNOT in our gate set here. So if somehow by measurements on a resource we can achieve one of these gates, we'll get universal classical computation. But what do we know about measurements on an unbounded sized cluster state? We know that we don't have an efficient way of simulating these measurements, because that would give us an efficient way of simulating quantum computation. But we do know that if we take a cluster state of bounded size, or even if we take a polynomial many copies of a cluster state of bounded size, simulation of measurements on that resource is something which is efficient on a classical computer. So it means that one of these resources cannot be quantum universal. Okay, but we do know that there are measurement patterns, such as this one again from this old paper, which implement universal classical gates. So this is the Toffoli gate. So if we take a resource which doesn't consist of a cluster state of unbounded size, but lots of little chunks, each of them big enough to implement a Toffoli gate, this will be a resource in this class here. Okay, so now that's a nice example of this, but it doesn't really teach us much. It shows that these kind of states exist. but can we get something a bit more illuminating? Well, what I want to do here is take a adopt a first principles approach, okay? Work from by first setting down precisely what my model is, and then trying to derive from that states which satisfy the conditions I want them to satisfy. So first I'll be a bit more strict about the precise model I'm looking at here. Okay, so what I'm going to say is I have a control computer and I'm going to fix its computational power. And in this case, it's fixed at this parity L computation. And there, then a resource state consists of a number of sites. And each of these sites are allowed to receive a single bit from the control computer. That would be determining the sine of the measurement angle for the cluster state. And they're only allowed to send back a single bit. That's the measurement outcome. These sites are not allowed to signal. In the cluster state model, once you've created your cluster states, your qubits don't signal with one another, but they may share pre-existing entanglement or even private, so shared private classical data. Okay? And other than this, I'm going to make no restrictions at all on the properties of the sites. The sites could contain anything. They could contain a full-scale classical computer, full-scale quantum computer. I'm not going to make any restrictions on that at all. Okay? And the reason why these restrictions are necessary is because if I allow this generality, which I need to be able to make statements about general resource states, there are trivial solutions to this if I don't make these restrictions. So if I imagine that these sites can contain a classical computer, if I were able to send two bits to a single site, then that classical computer could just calculate NAND, which is a universal gate, and then send it back. Okay. So these restrictions are quite important to avoid these sort of trivial solutions. So okay, I need one of these gates, and I need to be able to simulate one of these gates efficiently and repeatedly. Let's look at the AND gate, because it's nice and simple. Okay, and what would be the simplest way of achieving an AND gate? An AND gate takes two bits of input, and it gives one bit of output. So we're going to need at least two sites, because each site can only receive one bit. The sites will send back these measurement bits, M1 and M2, and we want to construct a state such that somehow the correlations here allow one to reconstruct the value of A and B. So there's some function on M1 and M2 which gives you A and B. Now, and also this function has to be something which can be evaluated on the parity computer. Now, we have this no signaling condition, and that's very important because that restricts greatly the sort of output that's allowed here. For example, we can't just assume that A and B is encoded in the value of M1, because then by setting the value of A to 0, this would act as a signaling channel which somehow signals the value of B from here to this output here. Okay, so that's not allowed by our framework. And in fact, the only thing which is allowed is that the parity of the measurement outcomes, or the inverse parity, is equal to A and B. That's the only thing that our conditions allow. Okay, that's great. This is a very simple condition. Let's find a quantum state which satisfies that. Okay, first of all, we should do a sanity check, okay? Is this sort of correlation even allowed? Okay, so we calculate the CHSH quantity, throw in all the numbers. What do we find? Oh, yes, the CHSH quantity is 4. Now, that's bigger than 2 root 2. That's bigger than Cyrilson's bound. And in fact, this device actually violates the Cyrilson's bound maximally. This is something which has been studied quite a bit in the literature, and it's called the Popescu-Rohlich non-local box. Okay. So to repeat, the fact that this violates Cyrilson's bound means there's no quantum system in nature which will have these kinds, well, if we believe nature is quantum and not made up of Popescu-Rohlich non-local boxes. So if we believe nature is quantum, there's no system we can find which will enable this kind of setup. So that's a little bit disappointing. Okay, but what do we know? So this sort of gives us a lower bound on the size of a resource state which will enable us to deterministically compute an AND. We know that if we have large enough, these fairly large cluster states, we can achieve autophily, but we know that two-bit resource states are forbidden because of Cyrilson's bound. So now we're going to look for the smallest resource which does enable AND. Okay, what's the fewest qubit entangled state which allows us this deterministic AND operation? Okay, so let's go back now to the GHZ paradox. Remember, this is the GHZ state satisfies these eigenvalue equations. And in fact, it's the only state that does so. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with the GHZ stabilizer equations, as we can call them. And I'm going to associate each one of these measurements with a bit. So I'm going to label measurement x as measurement 0 and measurement y as measurement 1. Okay? And the basic intuition behind that is that this is the measurement that's going to be made when my measuring device receives either 0 or 1. Okay? Now, if I do that, I can write this set of four equations in this form, which is rather neat. You see, we now have MA here, MA and B here. On the third qubit, we have a measurement which depends on the parity of A and B. And the eigenvalue which is returned is nothing other than minus 1 to the A and B. And if, instead of using measured eigenvalues plus or minus 1, we instruct our measurement devices to return bit values 0 and 1, so 0 corresponds to plus 1, 1 corresponds to minus 1, this is nothing other than the parity of these three measurement outcomes giving A and B. So this is almost what we wanted before. We now have these three sites. We send in three bits, A, B, and A plus B, and the parity of the measurement outcomes gives us A and B. So this GHZ state is a computational resource for calculating AND in the measurement-based model. And if I had an unbounded number of such resources, that would be a universal resource for universal classical computation. Okay, so we've got a GHZ state. Now, it's rather striking that we need three qubit states for the deterministic computation of this AND function, and two qubit states won't do. And this sort of, I mean, this is a very mysterious thing, which is hard to understand because it, I mean, it's closely related to the impossibility of achieving non-local boxes in quantum physics, which is itself quite a mysterious thing. But one of the things you could ask, for example, is there something about the tripartite nature of the entanglement? I mean, could bipartite entanglement do the same kind of trick? Well, in fact, it could, because we know from the PEP state formalism that we can build a GHZ state out of two Bell pairs. And if we just replace this with our central site sharing a Bell pair with one of these sites and a Bell pair with the other site, we could also find a set of measurements on this set of qubits, which also replicates the same measurement statistics. So somehow bipartite entanglement is enough, but just bipartite entanglement between two sites isn't enough. Okay, so let's summarize what we've looked at so far. We've introduced this classification of resource states by using complexity classes to really classify properly the computational power of the elements of this model. And we found these guys here, which you can think of as resources for measurement-based classical computation, which consisted of bounded size clusters, GHZ states, and of course the non-local boxes. And these other states over here, which appear to require a universal classical computer for their control. Okay, so what other things can we look at? What open questions are there? Well, okay, we saw that the whole argument that I outlined was based on demanding deterministic classical gates. So we wanted this AND gate to be deterministic. But what if we allow non-deterministic gates? I mean, it's feasible that non-deterministic gates could be useful. And then maybe the bipartite entanglement in a Bell pair could itself be useful. The reason for this is that you can take the CHSH quantity and you can rewrite it. Now, I said that this E quantity here was some sort of expectation value of parity, but you can write it as the difference between the probability of getting zero even parity minus the probability of getting odd parity. Okay, so it's the sort of expectation of this parity in a certain sense. But this is nothing other than you can then use this to write this in terms of the success probability for creating in the correlations which give you A and B. Okay, so this was the correlations that I wanted. I can rewrite the CHSH quantity in this form. Now, this is something which I found in a paper by Wim van Dam. I don't know if it's been more widely looked at than that. But if we then take this, we can rewrite the CHSH inequality to give us bounds on the success probability for achieving a non-deterministic AND using a two-qubit system. And classically, we'd be restricted to 0.75. But Cyrilson's bound gives us a higher probability. So potentially we could get to 85% probability with measurements on a bell pair. And maybe this is useful, okay? So can the CNOT computer somehow distill from this and leverage it up to a probability of success arbitrarily close to one? This is an open question, and I don't know what the answer is yet. This is something which we're looking at the moment. Okay, but one thing we can tell for sure is that we do need entanglement for to enable any sort of significant computational speedup. So what about if you used a separable state? Now, we know that separable states can be created by local unitaries and classical communication. That means in this model, we could do our classical communication before everything starts, okay, and our local unitaries after A has been received, after bit B has been received. But what that means is that this separable state resource could be just replaced by the classical randomness which you use to build the separable state. So at best, a separable state is going to be as useful as classical randomness. Now, it's not been proven that classical randomness does not enhance the power of this model significantly, and it certainly might enhance it a bit, but it's unlikely to enhance it up to full classical universality. Okay, and just one other quick comment. We can take this first principles approach and we can apply it to any function. And in fact, if we do that, we get a prescription for a resource, a set of correlations, which is compatible with a no-signaling theory. So if you look at generalized no-signaling theories and look at all the correlations which are compatible with no-signaling, you can find theories which have correlations just like this. And if you had correlations like this, regardless of the function, the logical computation depth to achieve this is only given by the depth of calculating this parity, okay? And parity calculations can be done in log depth. So if we ignore somehow the preparation complexity of building the correlation in the first place, this implies that in this generalized theory, all functions can be evaluated in log depth. So, and this framework could be used for evaluating more generally what the potential computational power of generalized no-signaling theories could be, because it could well be that we can find examples where we can solve problems which we don't think a quantum computer could efficiently handle. Okay, and almost before I finish, here's another aside, which is of an interest to computer scientists. So this is the model that I set up, okay, with the control computer here and the measurement sites and the communication. Okay. And this is something called an interactive proof system. Now, I don't want to say too much here, but these are very, very similar setups, okay? Here we have something called a verifier, which is a computer of limited computational power. It's allowed to exchange messages with these sites which aren't allowed to signal, which are called provers. And so far, this is just sort of a superficial similarity. But it could be that we can use some of the techniques and the techniques used in interactive proof systems and use this to formalize the kind of questions which we can ask to look at more general properties of the computational power of states. Okay, so I should finish off. So I've given a way of classifying resource states using ideas from complexity theory. And it's sort of led to all sorts of surprising connections. We've seen that this gives us a new way of formulating the GHZ and CHSH sort of games. And this is completely natural in a sense. I mean, the GHZ is a completely natural extension of the CHSH task of creating A and B in the three-body, in a three-party context. And there's been some work previously which has looked sort of within this sort of framework at tasks which could be achieved by measurements on entangled states of provers which share entanglement. And this has been given the name pseudo-telepathy. Okay. Now, this work now gives a whole way in which these results can be reinterpreted and, you know, reapplied and connected directly to measurement-based computation. Okay. So these are the sort of links I think I've explored in this talk. There wasn't much graph theory, for which I apologize, course, the graph theory is indeed hiding in here because it's fundamental to our understanding of measurement-based computation. Okay, so I think I'll finish there. I'd like to thank all of these people who've been very, very helpful and certainly contributed a lot to my sort of our development of the thoughts in this project. And this work is going to appear shortly on the archive. Okay, thanks very much.
So this paper by Van Dam shows that if you had a non-local box,
yes,
the communication complexity is just one bit.
Yes.
For any function.
Yes.
And then there was a follow-up by, I forget who the authors are, I heard about it from Harry Berman. He's one of them. Which shows that if, you know, if the error rate in the non-local box is below the classical fault tolerance threshold, then you can correct it and still get an error rate of one bit.
Yes.
And luckily, the EPR pair is below that threshold.
Yes.
So I guess, but it seems like you're trying to do the same thing, right? You're trying
to take
the correlations,
yes,
in the EPR pair and correct them.
Yeah.
So, but if you could do that, wouldn't that then show the communication complexity of any function was one bit, which we know is not the case?
Would it? No, I'm not sure. Oh, I see. You mean if this could be right? I think I see where you're getting at. So you're saying if this sort of non-deterministic thing could be leveraged,
yeah,
then that would imply
to the communication complexity case also.
I'm not sure because you would have to then. I mean, this would be sort of an asymptotic thing, right? So you wouldn't actually. I mean, your probability would be able to be raised arbitrarily close to one, but it wouldn't be one. That might make a difference here. But also, you'd have to.
I guess it depends how quickly convergence.
Yeah, it would depend on the convergence, and in a sense, whether you'd have to count. I mean, there's all sorts of communication. I mean, there's communication in the calculation of these parities, right? So each usage.
No,
of this,
the point is that since it's parities, you can just wait till the end.
But you can add them
parities on each side, and then that's where the
yes,
one bit
yes,
comes from.
Yes,
to
yes.
Compare it to the very end.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I have to think about that. Yes.
So you showed that you can't use a parity machine to get universal quantum computing using 2-qubit states because
yes,
there's no signaling requirement.
Yes.
That's got a Hilbert space of dimension 4.
Yes.
You showed that you can do it with GHZ states, which has a Hilbert space of dimension 8.
Yes.
Do you know that there are no possibilities in between those two, like a qubit and a qtrit, that you could maybe harness to give you why you compute this AND function using parity measurements?
Well, we know we need three sites because, I mean, Cyrilson's bound is derived without any assumption on the dimension of the system.
Okay.
So we need at least three sites.
Okay.
So you use reliance about Bell inequalities to limit the class of functions you could compute with two sites, for example. Can you turn your strategy around and from results about computability derive violations of Bell inequalities for more sites? Derive Bell inequalities for more sites? Or do you derive quantum violations or something like that?
Quite possibly. I mean, that's worth considering. But it's slightly subtle because when we go beyond the two sites in this model, let's find the picture, we're actually rather outside of the usual way people formulate non-locality games, because we do allow communication between the sites, but we allow sort of this restricted computational power which goes with that communication. So there's something subtle there. I think it may well turn out that you can construct inequalities in this framework, but they may not be precisely statements about the violation of local hidden variable models, but something more subtle. But it's certainly something that's worth exploring.
Okay.